Hi, everybody. It is Tuesday. My name's Tom Scott, co-founder of the Nantucket Project. I'm here again, as usual, with R. Pietti. And today, we're with Shoshana Ungerleiter. Thank you for being here. Shoshana is an internist in San Francisco and does a lot of work on the front lines, palliative care, et cetera. Essentially has good information on sort of what's happening on those front lines. One of the things I thought I would do today, I have a friend named Zach Kleit, who is a doctor at Columbia. He's a surgeon, and it is astounding what Columbia has done. This is a letter from him. It often seems like a soulless bureaucratic nightmare, the kind of place that spends months of people hours revising consent forms. This behemoth has taken 30 ORs out of commission and transformed them into multi-patient ICUs at breathtaking pace and with goodwill. All of the SWAT team members and the new ICU members are doctors or volunteers. Several of us have been sick. One was intubated yesterday and is in the ICU at Columbia. Yet the goodwill, and again, that phrase stands out. The doctors and the nurses greet each other, smile at each other, ask how their days are going, and help each other out in ways that I haven't seen before. I see on the news the doctors who are outraged about how hard it is to get PPE. At Columbia, we're not happy about the limitations, and maybe we'd grouse on CNN in the off hours, but you don't hear this in the hospital. When I ask people what they do with the masks that they just use in a patient's room, they cringe and explain that they put them in their pockets for reuse and then they wash their hands. There's no way that single use is viable right now. Anyway, you get the idea. I find it powerful, you know. Anyway, so a lot of good people on the front lines, and I'm curious, Shoshana, what you're hearing. I apologize.
No, it's an intense story, and I appreciate your friend sharing. You know, the places that are the hotspots, like New York, are absolutely overwhelmed. I'm hearing this from my colleagues there in the emergency room and in the intensive care units. They have double or triple the number of patients coming through their ERs. So it's actually impossible to keep the sick people isolated from one another because COVID presents in so many different ways. So it's actually hard to triage people. And as you know, we're not able to be testing people readily. I know that one hospital in New York City brought in a refrigerated truck to handle the volume of dead bodies coming out of the hospital in the last several days. So it's rooms lined with gurneys, with makeshift, you know, curtains, treating people with COVID. And many of these places, as we all know, are running out of ventilators day after day and having to beg for emergency supplies, and many of them aren't getting them. And we've all heard about these shortages of PPE, but the reality is that, you know, each one of those really tight-fitting N95 masks, we're taught, is supposed to be worn one time in one patient's room and then thrown away because everything on the outside of the mask is essentially dirty or contaminated. So my friends are getting one mask a week, putting it on during their shift and not taking it off for 12 hours, which means they're not eating and they're not drinking, because by touching the front of it, they're exposing themselves to these pathogens. And so, you know, a lot of the staff are trying to, wash their masks in bleach, which we don't know. That's not a tested way of cleaning it. You're supposed to throw it away immediately after you use it. And so they're consistently putting themselves, you know, at risk. And I think that's why many clinicians are getting sick and ending up in the hospital with this. And then I think, interestingly, a lot of my colleagues are shocked by the number of young, healthy people who are ending up very sick and even dying from COVID. We know that at least last week, around 20% of the people who were in the hospital were between the ages of 20 and 44 and otherwise healthy, which is alarming, you know, for those of us that fall within that age range or close to it, that for no reason, right? It's not an age factor. It's not an underlying condition that young, healthy people are getting quite sick from this. And so All in all, I mean, we all know this and we keep hearing it, but this was a battle that we are so ill-prepared for, and it's just completely overwhelming day in and day out. And so the doctors and nurses and social workers and respiratory therapists and janitors, you know, on the front lines are really going to battle every single day for us. And it's a horrendous time right now.
You know, it is. And, you know, some of my emotion was that, and some of my emotion is to the beauty of those people. You know, I went to school, you know, we have all known doctors in our lives. I was never that guy, you know, and I remember there's one kid I actually went to high school with who's in college and he's now a doctor. And he was just a giving person always. You know, he just was that kind of a person. And I do believe he was born to do that. You know, you meet people like that. Is that phenomenon, the spirit you heard from my friend Zach, is that pretty common?
Absolutely.
The quality of these people is special.
Absolutely. I think it, you know, medicine selects for people that are already kind of giving of themselves and service oriented, for sure. But I think in times of crisis, it really comes out in that beautiful, you know, human connection where people really are helping one another. And especially because a lot of these folks like aren't able to go home and see their families. They're physically quarantining, you know, either in their basement or their garage or in a hotel to stay away from their families to keep them from being sick. So there's a whole lot of camaraderie among clinicians going on right now, which is really wonderful and so needed. And I saw these photos in the last couple of days of hundreds, well, probably thousands of medical staff volunteers flying to New York City because Governor Cuomo has asked, you know, for anybody who's able to come out and help anyone with that's ever practiced medicine or has a license to show up and help. And I mean, that just brings me to tears. My goodness, people, you know, risking their lives to come to help.
If there's one most valuable way that somebody can help those people, or two, whatever the number is, but if people could take action today, what could they do? What could they do to help those people on those front lines?
Yeah, great question. Gosh, I have to say, first and foremost, and people keep on hearing this, but stay home. That's the best way that you can help those of us on the front lines is do everything you possibly can to stay at home. You know, still talking about this idea of flattening the curve. We're not even, at least my understanding is we're not even quite there yet in terms of a time when we can be flattening. We're still, you know, cases are on the rise, and that means every person that can stay home should at this point. It reduces the transmission of this virus markedly, and being really strict about social isolation too. It doesn't mean like hang out with friends on the weekends or go out on the weekends. It means literally all the time staying home, only being in contact with your family that you live with or your housemates, whatever it is. But that's the biggest thing that makes a huge impact right now.
Okay, that's helpful, very helpful. I'm going to switch topics now. RP, I want to go into the numbers a little bit, but you mentioned generally we're about to get bigger news, more profound news. Which tell us about what's happening in that realm.
Yeah, first, Dr. Ungerleiter, thank you for sharing all that. That was extraordinary. I think it's totally unacceptable that our people who have decided to serve us in the healthcare profession are not protected. And I think you make a great point that I think ultimately we also have to speak to our selfish interest. And so right now, you know, it's easy for us to say, gosh darn it, why don't the doctors have the PPE, the protective care? But when people start to realize that means that your nurse and your doctor is wearing a mask that was around infected people earlier, and that can help spread it, maybe people will start to take this even more seriously. So thank you. So big news is going to come out of the White House today. We talked yesterday about why Trump kind of changed his tune and went forward with, we need another 15 days of social isolation. That was like the big change that the White House described yesterday. And we talked about why that was, and it was obvious that he saw a series of epidemiological curves that scared him, and a variety of other things. There was some polling data that he also saw that said Americans right now, 9 out of 10 Americans are happy to do confinement for a while. That's a huge number of people as far as polling goes. And what we're apparently going to hear from the White House today is sort of what those numbers look like, what their curves show, how many people are going to be killed by this disease in America. And we understand that they're going to talk about 200,000 people in America will die from this disease at the bare minimum. That's my understanding of what the White House is going to say today. That's a lot. And we've had a lot of conversations, Tom, about how do you look at your R-naught, your transmission percentage, your CFR, your case fatality rate, how many people die who get it, and then effectively who's going to get infected, what percentage of America will get infected, what percentage of them will die, what percentage will have to go to the ICU, what percentage will have severe problems otherwise. And as Dr. Ungerleiter was saying, also, you know, it's also worth noting how many of those folks are under 70, right? So we're beginning to absorb those numbers. And as I was telling you yesterday, you know, our model is 200,000 would be an easy way out, that we'd be lucky to get 200,000. So we're going to hear that today. Be interesting to see how the response of the body politic, right? And here's a couple of things you're going to hear. One, hey, well, look, on a per capita basis, that's not so bad. You know, with 300 million Americans, that's one thing you'll hear. Another thing you'll hear is, well, compared to the flu, you know, flu would have killed 30 to 60,000 people. They're not going to die. Those flu people aren't going to die this year because we're washing our hands. So flu death is down. You'll hear that. A third thing you'll hear very correlated is, well, the number of people who died in America in this quarter or in this month is actually lower than have died in other years. That's true because we're not driving our cars. And, you know, there's a number of other reasons that we're not dying. So there's going to be a lot of people sort of understanding this. The quick way to think about those things is that's all true and thank God for it. But the other thing is this is incremental death nonetheless. These are people who would not have died otherwise, period, full stop. And this is stress and strain on our healthcare system that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So that's going to be big news coming out today. And then how do you absorb this depending on where you live, right? If you're in the New York area, I think our model says, you know, we're going to see we think we're 8 days away from the peak, 8-9 days away from the peak in the New York area. What that really means is listen to Dr. Ungerleiter. Don't leave your house. Don't have to bring your kid to the emergency room. Don't get in a car crash. Don't step on glass. Stay away from the emergency rooms. They're going to be super busy in the New York area coming up. And then it's going to move towards the middle of the country, right? So New Orleans is about to be on fire, might be 12 days behind New York. I'm not exactly sure of that number. Chicago is starting to pick up. And other cities are going to have this similar problem. And then the country is probably going to spike, the country, not just the New York area, in April, May, our first spike. What we should talk about is this flattening the curve. What's it take to get there? Well, what can we anticipate is going to happen?
Can we do that right now?
Yeah. Dr. Ungerleiter is making the point, the best thing we can do is stay home. We talked about this yesterday. Social isolation, physical isolation will absolutely defeat this virus if 90% of us or more do it. You made the point yesterday, Tom, that there's a large number of us who don't have the choice and have to get out and go to work. So that group has to wash their hands, practice distancing, not touch their face. For the rest of us who have the privilege to be able to stay home, we have got to do it. To be explicit, this government, our federal government, has not created the conditions to defeat this virus yet. The conditions would be a federal lockdown. You must quarantine lest there be penalties. We haven't done that. We've talked about why they're making that decision. They want to keep the economy open. They can't shut the green blood down just to save some red blood. I get it. It's a tough decision to make. But that means that the federal government, if we want the curve to flatten and stop growing and not rebound going forward, we got to do this once and for all. So when the president said over the weekend, let's do 15 more days of social confinement, of this self-quarantining, if we all take that seriously at the individual level, the mayor level, at the governor level, the CEO level, we actually can stop it. The data right now, and we're tracking cell phone movement data and other data where we can sort of see county by county where people are or are not social isolating, is not promising. So we're not doing what we ought to do. And it's because the leadership isn't forcing us to do it. And we have to go, wow, I want to go to the movies. I want to go hang out. I guess movies are off the picture now, but I want to go out and go to work. I get it. So if we can somehow have an awakening amongst the individuals in this country that stay home, listen to the doctor, we'll get over this. If we don't, we're going to have this spike coming up, and then we'll have another one. When that next spike is, and another one, another one, another one, just depends on when we finally stop interacting with other people. So the second spike right now, so the theory that we have is the spike April, May right now. The country begins to, you know, reopen end of May, June. We have a spike in July. And it just keeps on working like that. And then you have an August spike. So it's actually in our control for those of us who are privileged enough to be able to not go out to slow this thing down. And it's social isolating. It's also washing your hands and not touching your face. Sorry, Tom, go ahead.
Well, do you think that, you know, on some level, the government and the governments are going to have to iterate and
yes.
Are we getting better at that? It seems to be.
Yes, we are.
There's a reasonable cooperation thing that's growing.
Yeah. The other day we were looking at one of our curves and with our team, and I was like, no way, right? So this was, if you take the CFR, we believe, if you take the R-naught, we believe, if you look at, you know, the how much surge we think we can have in ICU beds, this curve was, holy shit, you know, millions of Americans dead. Like really, really horrible. And that's just math, right? And it was panic inducing to look at it. And the reason that it ain't gonna get there, Tom, is because we're gonna iterate, we're gonna learn. And we are, and we're seeing the president change his tune, right? And we're seeing more and more governors come on board with social isolation and physical isolation. And we're seeing individuals change their behaviors, right? So the data that we're looking at is from a company called SafeGraph, run by a great dude named Oren Hoffman. I think you know Oren, Tom. Oren's company has cell phone data about people moving around. It's I think tower switching. It's totally anonymized, but how many people are buzzing around this town or that town? And thankfully that is going down and down. It's not going down in a sharp angle like it should, but it's moving down slowly. And that's what has to happen. So just to be fully explicit,
where are the places in the country that people are moving around still? Like, do you have that information? I would like love to know that.
I could even pull it up. It's largely middle America. So just think about where people aren't terrified right now. So yes. I don't actually know where you are right now, but here, I'll pull up the model right now. So right now,
I'm in San Francisco, and this is a ghost town. Yeah, right. Literally so nobody York, is leaving.
You know, we're freaked out. Okay, so states that are moving too much. Wyoming gets an F. I get it.
There's not nobody. I mean, it's no one's there. Right. It's very, very spread out.
Arkansas gets a D. Montana, Iowa. As far as states that should be pay more attention, South Carolina gets a C. Kentucky gets a C. A's, people who are states that are doing it right, are DC, Nevada, which is interesting. Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Michigan. That's great. And doing better, Colorado, Vermont, California. So it makes sense. Alaska apparently is doing really well. That surprises me. Rhode Island, Washington, Connecticut, all get A's. Mm-hmm. Florida gets a B, not so bad. But I think the problem with that score I just gave you, I think it should be pass-fail. What we know from these numbers is if 90% of the people don't isolate, it just doesn't work. So it shouldn't be A, B, C, because I'm a C student, I'm fine. I'm still going to graduate from Brown, right? No. She pass fail and passes her A's.
So doctor, when you see the, if you were going to sort of rank, and maybe that's the wrong way to ask it, but what are the highest level problems that you guys are facing on a day-to-day basis? That'd be the first part. And the second part is, how do you think about the emotional, physical ability of the people on the front lines to sort of manage this over the next several weeks?
Oh man, great questions. Gosh, I don't know if I could rank them, but I would say high level, the big problems that healthcare workers right now are facing are this lack of PPE. It's huge. Yes, they've mobilized lots of organizations, lots of donations of N95 masks, gowns, face shields. People are getting very creative with 3D printing of these things. But that's huge. We have to keep our frontline healthcare workers safe. We already have a shortage of them. So when they fall ill and then have to be out of commission for several weeks, or if they go into the hospital, that's one less person who can be there treating patients. So that's a huge problem. I think that, this question of number of ventilators, again, we are mobilizing forces to be put more ventilators into the system. But you know, most projections are looking at on the order of hundreds of thousands of ventilators shortages, and that's huge. And then, so what does that mean for potential need for rationing care, which is something that nobody wants to talk about, think about? Clinicians are so fearful of this scenario. It's already starting to happen in some places where we just have to decide who lives and who dies. It's heartbreaking to even say it out loud. And in fact, the New England Journal of Medicine last week came out with an article where bioethicists weighed in on the need for hospitals to create a triage committee. So that's a team of doctors and nurses that evaluate the COVID-19 cases and then remove the burden of rationing care from the individual providers. And so it's one step removed, so that individual clinicians don't have to say to families or a patient, gosh, we can't provide this treatment for you because we have younger patients who are more likely to survive that are going to get it. I mean, that's something that's never talked about in medical school. It's a nightmare scenario for clinicians. But given that we know that only a minority of elderly people and those who have really serious underlying illness who are put on ventilators will survive and leave the hospital. I mean, gosh, this is a reality that we have to be discussing. And then, you know, a continuation of that would be encouraging everybody out there, but especially people in nursing homes and people who are, you know, older adults, to be having advanced care planning conversations. So discussing their wishes around end of life with the people they love and assigning a healthcare proxy who could speak for them if they can't speak for themselves. And potentially mitigating the need for more rationing care. If somebody truly says, listen, I'm 85. If I get sick from this, please provide hospice care for me at home. I don't want to be in the hospital. Now that's, you know, an individual's decision, you know, to think about and make, but these are the kinds of things that we have to be talking about. This is the reality right now. I think in terms of thinking about the emotional health of our frontline healthcare workers, I mean, there is palpable fear. I mean, doctors and nurses have taken to Twitter and Facebook to create community around sharing these stories, talking about how scared they are. I'm seeing, you know, male surgeons, a group of which typically I will say is not so forthcoming with their feelings. They don't like to show vulnerability, talking about how they're crying, you know, under their face masks every day because they're so scared that they're going to get sick and that they're going to infect their families and that their families are going to die. This is something completely unprecedented. We absolutely don't have the resources in place for our frontline clinicians to be getting the services that they need. I've heard of a couple organizations that are creating free hotlines or telemedicine platforms so that doctors can call in anonymously or chat in anonymously with a psychiatrist just to talk about how they're feeling, to get some a moment of reflection on just how terrible a lot of people have it right now. And I think we need to be thinking more about that and talking more about it, because the mental health of those of us, you know, us on the front lines, is something that is only going to continue to be an issue. And if we don't have healthy doctors and nurses and others, you know, to take care of people, who's going to do it?
Yeah. You know, just a quick personal story, and I'm going to cut to the end and say it doesn't end so badly as it may sound in the beginning, but My parents sold their house today. They sell their house after living in it for 49 years. But I convinced the new buyer to let them rent the house for a month. We're not doing this right now. But they did a walkthrough yesterday, and my parents had to leave the house in the walkthrough. Well, during the time that they left the house, my mother totaled her car. She is okay, but you know, it was a bad scene, and the paramedics came, and thankfully, this is would be my view, she refused to go to the hospital, which I think is a good move personally, based on what I heard. And so now she's back home, and my sister's in this situation where, well, we're all in this situation where we want to go help her, but we don't want to go help her. We think that may be the bad choice to go be with her. I think she's going to be fine. But it's, you know, only at this time do you make these kinds of decisions. And it's just incredible what's sort of going on out there. And it is also incredible that in, you know, I didn't know they were doing the walkthrough. I didn't know my mom was, my parents were going to leave the house. If I could unwind the whole thing, that would have never happened. But some of this is the kind of things that are happening with a lot of people. I mean, I think where some of that 90 falls apart RP is people unknowingly are doing things they don't even realize they're doing. You know, they're doing a walkthrough at my parents' house right now. It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, sorry for being personal there. You know, I have the numbers up here, and I use that on Johns Hopkins. I don't know if you've seen that one. Yeah. But, you know, the U.S., according to this, U.S. is at 175,000, and second is Italy with 105. You know, we're a pretty big country. We don't come anywhere near China and India in terms of size. Are we just way bigger? I mean, are we doing this that much worse than other countries? I mean, on a per cap basis, it may not.
Doing it worse.
We're doing worse.
Doing it worse. It's very simple. We're just doing it worse. There's no other issue.
Okay. And I'm going to assume there's a bigger number in India than we're seeing right now. Is that crazy to think? I mean,
India's done a complete, they've done it right so well as they can. They've done a complete lockdown with penalties if you leave your house, but they have millions and millions of migrant workers that are homeless now roaming around. I mean, I don't know what the actual numbers are going to be, but what were they, about a couple thousand recently? Yeah, I mean, the numbers are going to be much, much higher, obviously less testing, and probably will rip through some of the lower income groups really horribly.
Yeah. I forgot to mention one thing that I think would be top of mind for most clinicians, and that is more tests. I mean, we can't even get ourselves tested at this point at a rate that's reasonable and get results back fast enough. And so this, you know, the last several weeks, there's been this conversation from the TAP saying, well, we're going to get more tests. Private industry is making tests. I mean, we're not seeing them. I can't test my patients. It's a real problem. So until testing is ramped up, we're really stuck.
Yeah. So if you were going to, you know, Chris Cuomo has got the disease. I guess Putin was tested today and he does not have it. We just talked about a lot of heavy stuff here. Where do you see the mood, or just as best you can, RP, analyze the psychological state of the country right now, and anything that might be helpful to anyone who's watching this as to how to think about things right now, if you have it.
Well, there's been a lot of knowledge gathered by a lot of America about what this disease is. We're learning more and more about it. We're understanding how to not get it. We're understanding what happens when you do get it. And that awareness is moving across the nation, actually from the coasts internally. And it probably correlates almost perfectly to the state movements we were talking about earlier, the letter grades of how much people are moving around. The more people learn, the more they realize they have to socially isolate, and the safer they can be. What we talked about 9 days ago, Tom, is we're gonna go through this crest of panic into understanding, into grief. And I'm so sorry to hear some of what Shoshana was saying about, I keep looking for, hoping never to find, a story of an American dying because a ventilator was being used for someone else via triage. And the fact that that's apparently happened is horrible. I read a story of that happening in, I think in Italy, where an older woman gave up her ventilator to save a younger person, but it should never happen in this country. The ventilator story itself, it's a whole different story, and it absolutely boggles my mind, having worked on ventilators in 1996, right? So we're going through the grief and anger phase right now, And that's just like the knowledge wave, the panic wave, knowledge wave, and the grief wave is going to keep moving its way across America, but at different levels for different localities. As it comes closer, we'll be more aware and more terrified about it. And our leaders, you know, need to do a better job helping us walk through those processes together and protecting us. And some are and some aren't.
Yeah. Doctor, how would you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to touch on that point around grief. I think you're right that we're going to hit a more collective period of time around grief, probably in the next weeks and months. But I also think that we can look at grief not just in the context of huge losses of life or of health or jobs, but I think it's actually really bigger than that. There are these losses of regular life as we knew it. Missed graduations, postponed weddings, that dream vacation that you saved up for 30 years to take was canceled, separation from family and friends when we need them the most. I think we've also lost the predictability that we take for granted in daily life. That's huge. And I think is this insidious grief that no one's talking about yet, but I think we need to be. And we need to be coming together and dealing with some of this, because if we don't, that can manifest in really bad ways. So I do think that this grief conversation is so important right now.
I think the thing people really want to know is, you know, and you answered some of that today, how close are we to that ventilator, it's a crisis right now moment? And how close are we to those, to the that moment where we're having on a large scale these important decisions where you decide that's this person has the ventilator and that person doesn't? And how big might that be?
I can give you some numbers. It's a super moving target. Let me look at our graph. It's possible that we'll have a gap of north of 50,000 ventilators gap. Could be markedly higher. There are 16,000 ventilators in the U.S. strategic stockpile. And physicians and hospital staff have been really crafty about doubling and some instances quadrupling the capacity of ventilators. So, you know, we have the offense defense. So on the offense side, the disease is moving. More and more people need ventilators. And those people at a very high percentage die without it. On the defense side, we've got some ventilators to deploy around the country. We're not going to be, the new building of ventilators is not going to help us for this first peak, period, full stop. Those are months away. And we have really smart doctors figuring out how to get more ventilator use per person. So we'll see. And it's like a foot race.
We're in it now. Doctor, how are you seeing similar?
Like RP said, you know, this is a moving target in terms of numbers of ventilators needed. We just don't know. I think that right now it's much more focused regionally or where these hotspots are, where there's current shortages, or if there's a period of time by which, you know, there's a need and then a cohort of patients die and then or they get better, right? Best case scenario. And then those ventilators can be used for other people. And so are we seeing that across the country at this point? No. When might that happen? I think we're weeks and maybe months away from that. It's just so hard to say. I would say in California, we're not dealing with that. We, you know, Gavin Newsom did a great job locking down the state. People have been, I think, for the most part, fairly compliant, and hospitals are not seeing this huge surge that New York has had over the last couple of weeks. That said, we think it's probably coming, but it isn't here yet.
Is that a top of mind? Is that a regular conversation that you're seeing within the hospitals and amongst the healthcare workers?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, for sure. They're already, you know, our hospitals already buying up a bunch of new ventilators, thinking about surge capacity, where can we put patients, you know, if we absolutely are bursting at the seams, much like how, you know, it's happening in New York City here we have a little more room than they do. And so there's more options, but it's a very, very high on the list of our priorities right now.
And is that, are the frontline people well informed by the hospital staffs or whoever sort of shares this information? Do they have a sense of where they are in that curve, or do they just do their work and keep their head down and hope for the best? What do you see?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere in the middle. I think that, you know, and I can just speak for our institution, you know, the CEO, the other administrative folks are trying to do their best of sending out a daily briefing on COVID, number of cases, who's recovered, who's still needing care, both, you know, regular hospital and then the ICU. I think most clinicians are just trying to keep their heads down and get their work done and hopefully get home to their families each night. But I do think that there is an effort being made to keep frontline healthcare workers abreast of what's going on.
Yeah. Thank you all for spending the time, and RP, I'll talk to you soon. And Dr. Shoshana Ungerleiter, I hope to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks, doctor.
RP, I wanted to call you back and just get one more comment before we went. Today was a bit of a bummer day. I think you feel the same. I'm just curious how you would react to that. And I wanted to hear that before we went.
It was a downer day because we have to confront the hard facts, and you can't actually be an optimist. You can actually fix things unless you're willing to confront the brutal truth. The brutal truth right now is bad. It could be a whole lot worse, but it's bad. But we now know what we're up against. Every single person in America has the capacity to help stop this, and it's actually in our control. We don't have to blame good or bad government or good or bad disease. This is up to us now, period. Even if you have to leave your house, even if you are not able to socially or physically quarantine, you can wash your hands, not touch your face, stay away from other people. And if you're in a situation where that's not the case, you got to get yourself out of that situation. But it's in our control right now, and we can stop it. And let's stop waiting for the leaders to tell us what to do. We don't need them to tell us. That's part of the American spirit. We can do it on our own, right? Let's do it ourselves. We know exactly what we have to do. It's in our control, and we can do it. And I tell you what, we're going to be out of this thing in a few months. If we do it properly as a country, we're out of this in 4 weeks. If we keep bouncing along the road, it's going to get better. It's not going to be 9 months of peaking. It's going to get better each time.
Very helpful. RP, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.